Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Friga. I'm going to go through some material, but this is going to be completely customizable, so we can go deeper or shallower in different areas as you see fit. It's great that we have a financial expert in the group. So I don't have a clicker, so I'm going to stand up there for a second, and I'm recording for, I guess, prosperity. So a couple of comments as to my background related to financial forecasting. So you know my general background, but just to highlight this, I went to St. Francis, and then I started with PwC. I did get my CPA and my CMA while I was there, Certified Management Accountant. I even audited West Virginia Wesleyan, I might have mentioned that. And then I transferred into bankruptcy turnaround consulting for 4 years. So I worked with companies in running financial models when they were really in trouble and doing some turnaround work. So I really enjoyed that. Went to University of North Carolina for my MBA. Then I worked for McKinsey & Company doing strategic consulting, ran models on every project, even did a project in higher ed, and came back for my PhD in strategy. And since then, the past 20 years, I've been teaching strategy, and I teach consulting, and I teach students how to do the consulting projects that always include some financial analysis and projections. And I've done hundreds of projects for higher ed, for organizations. I really like doing not-for-profit ever since I turned 50. And I always bring MBAs and undergrads now, so I have other people running my models. But every project we always do, let's look at your baseline financials. Let's look 3 years out. Let's look at scenarios. So I'm very familiar with this topic, and I'm a big fan of it. And I'm shocked at sometimes higher ed institutions don't do this. Sounds like you guys do, which is great. You know, they just don't talk about financials. They don't look 3 years out. They don't do multi-year forecasting. So if everybody's already familiar with that, I may not have much more to add. And we can talk about anything you want. But this is just some of the basic material that I plan to go through. The importance of multi-year forecasting, and then I'll give you... you might like this. I have real data that I've gathered that does some benchmark comparisons of the other institutions within the Wesleyan family, so you can get some sense of it. And you can tell me that that'll look wrong or whatever, but it might lead to an interesting discussion. And then we'll talk about some discussion questions. So I've already mentioned this before. You got over 30% of institutions running financial operating deficits right now. I mean, that just astounds me. And many of them aren't even really talking about it. You know, the $77 billion by the federal government for COVID relief have really just kind of masked over things. Some people still haven't really addressed this. And so there's more pain coming over, as enrollments are really going to be stiff. There's going to be more fallout and more change necessary, more transformation. But so this just sets the stage that, you know, the old model of, that's okay, we'll just increase tuitions next year and enrollments will stay solid 3 to 5% a year for the past decade, doesn't work anymore. So it's going to be a different kind of solution. So that just sets the situation. So what are people doing about it? The biggest lever you can pull financially is changing your academic programs. By far, that's going to be the biggest percent of your spend on any institution. Usually about 60% at least of the spend is on instructional spend. And of course, a lot of that is personnel. So those are hard decisions. And no one, you know, a lot of our institutions are also considered employers, and that's a part of their mission. But that's where changes typically have to happen within the programs. We're decreasing certain programs. I always say, though, that you should be increasing programs at the same time. So if you're going to decrease some of these, you should be introducing new ones that are more in line with what people are demanding or fit the Wesleyan portfolio. I'm coming out of this meeting really optimistic that you can start operating more as a system and start working more collaboratively together and take advantage of academic programs that somebody else has if you could offer it at your campus. But I don't know if you'll get there, but that is a big thing. The other thing that's happening are mergers and affiliations. Again, this is you kind of have a loose affiliation, but you can move toward a stronger affiliation, and there would be lots of synergies on academic programs and other things as well. Natural period of 3 to 10 years, so some of these go a little bit longer. But every time you do analysis of options, you should tie it back to financial impact. That's what consultants typically do. Hey, if we're going to do this collaborative stuff on programs, what are the financial ramifications? Oh, it could be increased revenue and decreased costs. Really, tell me more. And so you have to model that out. And you typically would do it, I recommend, 3 years of historical data and 3 years of forecasting. Sometimes you can do more, but it gets a little wonky in years 4, 5, 6, 7. Capital budgeting obviously goes longer, but I really like the three-year sweet spot. And many trustees, especially coming from the business world, are comfortable with this paradigm. Academics are not. Academics are last year's budget, this year's budget. That's all they typically think about. And sometimes they forget all about last year's budget. They don't even want to do a budget to actual comparison. They just want to know my budget. And I want my budget to be the same as last year or go up. That's kind of how academics approach it. So you got to, it's a little bit of a paradigm shift to think in terms of true financial modeling. So what are the key success factors? Well, one is you just have to understand the baseline numbers. And I'm going to show you just a couple slides that I think all trustees should ask for on a regular basis. When I was a trustee at St. Francis, we tended to get big financial packets, like 25 pages or more of table after table. And I would digest it, but it was never easy. It was almost painful to get to what's the so what. Let me give you one so what. The one time I got, it was actually one page. It was an analysis of the student to faculty ratio and faculty costs over the past 10 years when I was at St. Francis. And I just happened to look at the ratio, and we weren't really talking about this topic, but I was like, I noticed that over the past 10 years, we went from a 20-to-1 student to faculty ratio to a 10-to-1. And I said, is this on purpose? Oh, it's a more personalized education. But the more I pushed, it wasn't on purpose. We didn't say that's our vision. We did it because this is the explanation. Well, do you know what the explanation, you know what I heard?
Yeah, we kept the same number of faculty and we had fewer students.
Worse. We brought more faculty in to replace lines, and we gave people tenure when they earned it. Whether or not we needed another tenured professor of biology or not, we didn't analyze that. They earned it. And I was like, wait a minute. Shouldn't you be looking at the ratios in each area? Shouldn't you be looking at the costs of the classes and the structure before you? No, if they earned it, we need to give it to them. So that's an academic mentality. I'm a hybrid, right? I'm an academic, but I also understand, no. I think we should look at more than one decision criteria that they earned it. Well, you got to make that decision back when you offered them a position. And I'm like, you're going down an unsustainable path. So you got to understand the basic. Oh, and I said, because when I look at this, if we were back at a 20-to-1 ratio, we would have $2 more million of operating budget. And the room went silent. I don't know where they are in the student to faculty ratio right now. The next thing you do is once you have these basic numbers and you see them, then you can start playing with scenarios. And this really became popular during COVID. The military, I have military clients, they've been doing scenario planning for a long time. If this happens that way, what does that do to the financials? So if we have fewer students, what does that do? If we have more online students, what does that do? So you got to think through the ramifications. I feel like I'm probably telling you guys things you already know. And then you look at any new strategic planning initiatives. And this is something, you know, don't give me a laundry list of 20 things you want to do. I want to know the big things, and I want to know how much they cost and what the return should be. And if you don't give me some, and that's hard to do. Somebody in the last group said, why don't you think trustees have these kinds of discussions? I said, one is there might be a bad situation and nobody really wants to talk about it. So you're trying to just avoid the topic. Sometimes presidents and CFOs might obscure it a little bit because they're not ready for you to address it because they're working on fixing it. That's what how they would justify it. So if it's cloudy, sometimes it's because there's a problem. Or it's a competency issue on the trustees or the president's cabinet. Or you're just not asking the right questions. So it could be one of those three things. Hopefully none of those for yours. This is the most important chart you can ask for. And it doesn't look complicated here, but I'm telling you, I worked on a project for a small private institution, And they said, we're in good shape. We have the strategy. The president figured out the strategy. We just need you to come in and help us socialize it on campus so we can launch it. So I come in January. First thing I do is I start running my basic financials. I take their financial statements and I put a little model together. And this is loosely based on that situation. And so we were right here. I'm making this up to look like this is an inflection point, but we were right here. I said, you do realize, and the numbers are way off, we had a $5 million operating deficit last year, $1 million the year before that. And before that, we were breaking even, but it was tight. And so don't pay attention to these numbers, but this trend. So we're here. And the trustees were like, what? We're what? And so they had no idea. And it was all in the financials, but it had never been put on a chart. Just show me, are we covering or operating? And you might have some non-operating. Sometimes financial statements are complicated, but you can simplify them. So as trustees, ask for the simple version. Financial statements, you got to know that this is recorded as that. Okay, just find a way to pull things together to tell me on an operating basis, are we covering our expenses? So that's where it starts. And then show me the projections for the next 3 years, baseline projections. It seems intuitive, but it's not always available. The next point is, if you were in my earlier session, I said you might have three big priorities and some objectives. These are called initiatives. These are things that we're going to do to achieve those objectives. And it's kind of a three-year plan. When I do a project, every one of those has to do a cost estimate, which is new dollars or personnel that we're investing in this, plus an impact. And that means cost avoidance or revenue creation. And that's hard to do. There are some people who just can't get their arms around it, but you can quantify anything. It just takes work. If you increase retention, that translates to 5 more students over the next 3 years. So let's put their net tuitions in. You see, you can run numbers like that. So every time you have a plan, you have to say, I want to know how much it's going to cost us and what it's going to generate. And then you get another simple chart that looks like this. This is the incremental strategic investments. We had three big priorities: create, grow, and expand. If you look back, create a compelling vision and grow athletics, grow research, expand external partnerships. Okay, each one of those is going to cost a certain amount of money, is going to generate revenue. Show me what that looks like over the next 3 years. Well, the first year we're not investing much. It's mostly analysis and preparation. The next year, we're investing a lot in purple, and that's imperative to growth. This one costs the most. Why? Because we're starting a new nursing school. So that's going to cost a lot of startup cost, and it's not going to generate a lot of revenue for about 3 years till the students come in. But you have to see what that impact would be on a multi-year forecast. And so it's even more expensive here. Now, the revenue from the other things we're doing starts covering costs in year 3. You're not really getting a full return on investment until like year 5 or 6. You could have this built out in your model, and nursing's really going to start paying off down the road. But you have to do, some of these are upfront investments. But you can see, if you have a strategic plan and you propose a bunch of things, tell me how much they cost and what it's going to generate in revenue. And a lot of institutions don't do that. I want to find out more if you all do. But that's what companies do. They have to justify investment with a business case. This is one of my last slides, I think, is, you know, I talked about a performance dashboard before. Don't again, give hundreds of pages of documents to the trustees. Just say, how are we doing on our big priorities? We've got a priority for students, academics, campus, and financial. So we're introducing new majors, new master's programs. Tell me what our progress is. And it can have drill down data and tables behind it, but just give me a visual of how well we're doing. And that this is called a dashboard approach. So I'll stop there, and then I'm going to show you some real data from the Wesleyan institutions. But any reactions or questions on what I covered so far?
Mm-hmm. So many times, can we be honest, we're all family here, right? Some of our trustees feel shocked because they don't really understand as things go along whether or not they're moving in the right direction or the wrong direction. And I'll give you an example. A lot of our boards, obviously, because we're an institution of Wesleyan higher education, our emphasis on Wesleyan and higher education, we have a lot of clergy and we have a lot of professional educators. We love our clergy and we love our professional educators, but they're not always the most necessarily fiscally astute. Now, the auditors, as part of our responsibility of the board to receive the auditor's report, to look at it, to accept it, mm-hmm. to vote on it, and to approve it, including the letter from the management letter and all that sort of thing. And you can see these glazed eyes.
Yep.
Because it's just page after page after page. It's like our fixed expenditures went up this way and all that sort of thing. But a dashboard indicator like that previous slide, where you pick out the top 15 things or something like that, that's understandable to any board member. To any board member, that's great. I know we're getting electronic versions of all this stuff. Is that in your...
Yeah, this isn't... I mean, this slide deck's been sent. And behind this, by the way, is a table that has data of expectations, current results, difference, right? So there's and behind that is an Excel spreadsheet. So, like, there are drill downs, but you got to get to this level to make it quick to say, let's talk about this one. Why are we so off on this?
But there's some members of the board for whom that drill down is essential, or they're not convinced that that's right.
Right.
They want a drill down.
And others don't care about all that.
Right.
They just want to...
Exactly.
So simplifying it is the key. And I just think it's a deficiency. When I was a trustee, I actually dove into all that. And the auditor reports, we had great auditors, and I was always the one who said, tell us more about the ratios, because the ratios are where you can really pick stuff up. But it wasn't presented really easily. So I have some ratios in here, I think, that you can pay attention to. Faculty, staff, salaries, and graduation rate. Student to faculty ratio, you should always track.
Going to be a whole different set of reports than what other trustees who serve on student life.
Well, see, it is at the detail level, but it still should be aggregated up so that every trustee sees the big picture. So you are right. They'll go deeper in the finance committee, and they would be the ones to verify the assumptions are reasonable, and we feel comfortable with it. But then it should be that everybody can just look at it and get a feel.
But even I'm in academic affairs, we talk about the student to faculty ratio and what is and what the changes are on those aspects. So,
and what is the student faculty ratio right now?
I don't remember what it is right now.
That's a pet peeve of mine. Not that you don't recall, but just that so many people are like, it has to be as low as possible. And I'm just like, really? Does it? I just told you the story. I'm starting to get all my stories mixed up. I just told you about 20 to 1, 10 to 1. I mean, there people when it was 20 to 1, people weren't running around saying, the student-faculty ratio is terrible. I'm unhappy with my education. There was none of that. But because it went down, people were like, yeah, that means we have a higher quality of education. Not necessarily. I've seen no evidence of that.
Programs where it had less students coming in, and then that created a higher faculty or student rate. So we talked about that. So what do? We sunset this?
Yes, you have to sunset some programs, and no one will ever want to do that.
Yeah, but that's
and trustees should be talking about that stuff. They shouldn't be picking which programs, but they should be making the university have those discussions. And the only way you see it is you aggregate it up, and you say, tell me the progress on student to faculty ratio. Mm-hmm. Well, we've analyzed it by each area, and nursing is 4 to 1. We think we can take it to 10 to 1 because it's very clinically based. But we think we can take business to 30 to 1, and they're only 20 to 1. You know, those are good strategic conversations, and then you let them make the changes. Any other reactions or questions or comments before we go to the raw data? And we're going to have a discussion about what do you do at your institutions after we go through this. Okay, this could be fun. So what do we have? Indiana Wesleyan? We got them?
Yeah.
Oklahoma? Houghton? And Southern, okay. Okay, well, I don't have data on the seminary because... My team, this is quick and dirty. I wasn't hired to do any benchmarking analysis. I just thought it would be interesting to people who come to this particular segment to have this. Some of them said, in the earlier session, said, you should have shared this with everybody and got everybody excited in your first session. But I only had an hour. So this is from a source called How Colleges Spend Money. I find it to be fairly reliable. It does often go to iPads and other sources. But this is administrative costs per student. Okay, so I don't know what the right number is, but it gets interesting. Every project I do, we do a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, and we do a benchmarking analysis to get some understanding plus projections of how you're spending. So this is administrative spend. So Indiana Wesleyan, and remember, this is, you know, the denominator is number of students. I mean, so this is driven a lot by the number of students. And one of the problems you have when you're small and autonomous is you have to build an infrastructure, and so you're going to be more expensive. That's the theory of if you were one Wesleyan University and you didn't have to absorb all technology costs and HR costs and finance costs and somebody else was giving it to you at a smaller, that's the theory that you can be more efficient, that model. But when you're autonomous, it's more expensive. So I think we'll see some of that. So that probably explains Oklahoma, you're the smallest, right? So that probably explains in general. But then you also start looking at trends over time. So I'm not seeing a ton here, except I would say pretty moderate, a little jump here, and this is from 2016 through 2020, a little bit of up and down, but generally I would call it pretty, now the something's happened here, you might be decreasing students more or you're spending more. I don't know, it's one of those two variables. And we don't have to analyze that right now. But when this ratio goes up, it's either fewer students being allocated or you're spending more, or both. This is I don't understand this one, so maybe somebody from Indiana Wesleyan can explain it. Something happened around 2016, 2017, or maybe even 2015 that caused a big jump. So you either decreased students... Or you made an investment.
Did you get this out of iPads?
This is probably iPads.
Okay, what happened was we separated into two iPads numbers after 2016. So you probably are picking up just after 2016, you're picking up just our residential campus. And prior to that, it's all combined.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's
a weird story.
I know, it is a weird story. So
at this point, were you still including online students in your... And here you're not.
And here we're not, right.
Well, I knew there was some explanation because it was a weird jump and then it was steady.
It's
a reporting. Okay. For the balance scorecard.
The balance scorecard, yeah.
Okay.
So we had to separate it out.
Okay. All right, so you look at benchmarking data for reasonable explanations or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
And if you don't have one, you're like, why are we spending more? So, and I assume if, for example, if you were to add those students back, would you have stayed steady? That would be the follow-up question. Okay, good. Thank you for being here and explaining this. Similar in student services. Now, why didn't we see that in administrative? Why didn't we see the jump there?
I have no idea. It should have been.
Obviously, instructional cost is a much higher cost of your
exactly.
of on campus. So maybe you are really efficient?
Administratively, probably between the two units on an administrative basis, because you're not using any instructional cost there. It probably is pretty consistent. But that would be.
But even by changing the student number, it should have changed this more.
Well, the students, it's proportional. So, yeah, it's the administrative cost of the students on that campus.
But you didn't include online students in this number going forward.
Nor the costs.
The
cost came down and the students came down.
But then would the instructional costs have been pulled out from this?
Well, that would have been, yeah, but that, the instructional cost, it has a lot fewer students. So the instructional costs are a lot higher on an area campus. A lot higher.
Okay.
Where it would have, if you take admissions,
this conversation is a good conversation. We're not going to solve for this, but this kind of stuff, do you have these conversations with trustees or not? I don't remember much of those. So this is, again, so weird in 2016. But here you do have the, obviously, you got to see, this is the challenge. Unless you got more students miraculously, you're going to have a tough ratio on administrative to instructional cost. And, you know, that's a pretty high number. Now, I'd like to see, like, benchmarked against more institutions and, you know, that sort of thing, and try to figure out which buckets of cost we could do something with. But this is when you start saying, why don't we pool our instructional, you know, this is where we talk about pooling strategies across the different institutions. This is inflation-adjusted tuition. This is as a percent of median income. This is interesting. I bet there's got to be something going on here. What happened at Oklahoma Wesleyan in this year? This is class analysis. So this is a four-year graduation rate of that class. And it wasn't COVID because this was pre-COVID. So this is like graduating by 2015 or 2016. That's a really low graduation rate. Maybe you changed the composition of students. You had more part-time students. You had different, I don't know. But again, I'm not here to solve it, but these are kind of questions you would have. Anybody have a theory there? Oklahoma State? Oklahoma Wesleyan, I mean? Yeah, it's a while ago. It's over a decade ago. So anyway, but this is the value of benchmarking. And that's why every time I do a project, we do benchmarking, we do financials, we do a SWOT analysis to get started. And then we start hypothesizing about strategies, and then we start doing, you know, strategy statements, and then we come up with a plan, and then we do multi-year forecasting. So that's my spiel. Any questions on that? By the way, I have a feeling we're going to finish early with this group. Okay, here's my discussion questions. So I'm going to sit down and we're going to have it. And we can talk about whatever you want. But this is what I thought might be interesting. And I think you've answered some of these already. Do you feel, not necessarily you, but if you speak on behalf of your trustees, would you say your trustees have a decent level of understanding of the finances of the institution? I'm seeing a couple yeses and a couple noes. So we got a mixed consensus here.
I mean, I think the finance committee is picked because they've got...
Sure, of course.
I mean, the audit committee goes through and the investment committee goes through.
Yep. What about the trustees as a whole?
Whether the student life committee would pay as much attention or academics. The full board does get presentations every year on budget because there's typically two budget meetings.
Right. That's usually when you have the biggest group discussion.
Yep.
Multi-year forecasting in there too?
Usually there's changes of what's happened. I mean, it's typically like a three-year, one past this year, one future. So it's not necessarily a five-year that was.
But I guess I'm officially usually thinking 3 years back, 3 years forward, so that would be 6 years, but only 3 years forward. But it, so you think of it as a year back current and a year forward.
Typically, I think that's how it's usually addressed.
Okay.
Do you think it should be a couple of years forward?
I think so. I think so because the strategic plan should go more than just next year, right? So you should be thinking of the impact more than just next year. But that paradigm is the faculty paradigm. I think I mentioned that. They don't even do 3 years. They don't even care about last year's budget. Faculty want to know this year's budget. They'll do a one-year paradigm. That I think. I mean, and higher ed institutions typically they put a lot of energy into the budget, but they don't put as much energy into two more years. That's kind of the reason I'm having this segment is I just don't think enough of us go a couple years out. Now you don't have to go to the same level of detail you do in the full budget. It could be more summary level. Other reactions or thoughts?
I admit I go deer in the headlights over the numbers, but Nancy does a fabulous job at bringing the charts and showing trends and comparisons with other CCUs and projecting out 5 years, for example. So that helps me more than anything. I have she does drill down in the meeting. You know, she'll say this goes here and this goes here, and I'm going blurry.
But I go blurry. I'm on boards, but I need to see the big picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'm like, I trust her.
Yep.
Do you all get a report ahead of time that's more a story, telling a story? Mm-hmm. I think that's a key thing.
Yep. Like summarizing the so whats.
Yeah, but to me, it's a story. It's not like pages filled with numbers.
Right. An executive summary.
Didn't always get that. Nancy has moved forward with that, and I, as a board member for a long time, a lot of times we didn't have any financials till we arrived at the board meeting, and then it was like, oh, let's give it to you.
And try to try to react to it in the meeting.
Nancy does really good about that. So, I mean, that's what I appreciated, is that we get something before we can look at and have questions when we get the board meeting.
And I think having an executive summary or the key so what's, even on a one-pager, like a presidential briefing, that is worth its weight in gold.
Pages, but it tells a story.
Yep.
And if there's some MD&A, management discussion analysis, along with graphs, or along with a quick high level, so I do one for the seminary too. But so you could read that, even if you're a really novice person. That's the whole, you know. And if you're not getting it in English, that's what you should do. Because I think finance people make things, it is complicated, but they don't know how to make it simple.
Right.
And
it's that mid-range of information that's missing. Not the detailed granular level that's appropriate for the finance and investment committee. I was on the finance and investment committee, I think, for 7 years. And we needed to dig into those numbers. Mm-hmm. But not a C-spot run version, but that 15 dashboard things. That's the mid-range level of information that's meaningful. That even your professional educators and your professional clergy and your student life committee and that sort of thing should be able to read and understand and say, oh, we're right track or we're wrong track.
Yeah. That's all. It's to give you the benchmark, and I guess that's what you do, a dashboard, and then put big circles around, let's talk about, these are the things that are really positive.
Yeah.
We don't need to talk much about them, but let's talk about the things that are looking bad. That's where you need energy.
Yeah.
Like, what do you talk about? You should be talking about the places where we're having problems and brainstorming solutions. But some people don't like to bring up negative news in a board meeting. They would rather try to keep it all positive. And the problem is, the board has a fiduciary responsibility to address the tough things and talent to help. But there are cabinets out there that are hesitant to bring up the bad stuff to the board.
I think sometimes you have to ask in the projections, have you changed any of the assumptions that are built into the future numbers?
You can
because
make it look with what
you
want.
Yeah, you can make the number keep going up even while things are falling apart.
Yeah,
you
know? Exactly.
Yeah, that's also a common thing.
Yeah.
That just saying, oh, next year we expect enrollments to go up 5%. You said that for the past 2 years. It's not going to go up. And by the way, if anyone comes to you with that, it's not going to go up. Unless there's some dramatic new program or a huge marketing campaign, you're not going to see bumps. I've seen so many of them just say, no, it's coming up next year. We're making better inroads with our admissions teams. It's not going to happen without some major change.
This is where the lawyers would say you're assuming facts, not yet in evidence.
Any other thoughts or reactions? I have two other ones. Have you been presented? We've already covered that. We've covered all those. So how are we doing on time? We're doing great. I actually feel this is kind of a knowledgeable group. This is what makes me nervous. The people who didn't come this are the ones who really gloss over, and they're like, somebody else will take care of that. And I wish they would come to this because I'm speaking to them. No, you know what I mean? It's like sometimes the people who need something the most are not the ones who admit they need to hear it. They don't have an interest in it.
Can we talk about strategic planning just from kind of a high-level perspective? Okay, it's out of Weston. We just inaugurated a new president just a few months ago in October, Dr. Barker. We're all excited about him. He's a great guy. He's got a lot of positive press, a lot of enthusiasm. And everyone is expecting sometime in the next year, new president, new administration, new strategic plan.
Okay.
Right. That's obviously going to be a collaborative effort between the president, his cabinet, administration, and the board.
Maybe. Not always.
Well, hopefully.
Okay.
Best case scenario, ideal scenario. What are the elements of an ideal strategic plan?
You should have come to my earlier session. I got a whole slide deck on this. But I'll just summarize my answer. And those, you can have those slides.
Okay.
But, and I think moreover, how do the trustees engage in the process?
Yes.
So one question, what's in a plan? Two is, how does trustee engage? What's in a plan? And I do have slides on that. I was kind of being facetious, but a clear, succinct mission statement that talks about our unique positioning, and it can't be just teaching, research, and service, or even just Wesleyan. It has to be more than that. A vision statement of where we want to go, 3 years typically, maybe a little longer, what we want to accomplish at the high level. Some sense of our values, no more than three, and most importantly, three top priorities over the next 3 years. I just want you to tell me, what are you going to be working on that for change? It needs to be the change agenda, not to put everything that you do operationally into a strategic plan. I see too many people do that. Just tell me the three big change areas. For example, and then, by the way, it would drill down for each priority. You would have some objectives over the next 3 years and some initiatives. And that was the example I put up there. I've been brainstorming. People have been just kind of going there naturally. But if I were to help put a system-wide strategy together for the Wesleyan system, that doesn't exist per se, but the family, the Wesleyan family, for all the institutions, the mission is something about Christ-like servant leaders, somewhat like what not just to be priests, but something unique about higher education for the whole person, something like that, a really short statement that the one true Wesleyan way, because I think there are other Wesleyans too, and you guys are more pure to the, I guess, I don't know the whole history, but something really succinct like that, a vision, double the number of Wesleyan family students over the next 6 years. I'm making that up, but some great vision like that. Okay, we're gonna grow our way out of this. And then you have some set of values that speak to your uniqueness, but then you got three priorities. One is complete collaboration of all academic programs across each institution. Hybrid, online, like the stuff I talked about. I mean, break down all the walls. You're gonna be known for this, you develop that. You can still have some other things, but we're gonna decrease the investment in those, because students can take it from our institution, we'll hold the faculty, right? So it's a big collaboration on the academic side. Two is joint marketing campaign. So we will go out as the Wesleyan universities, or the true Wesleyan universities.
We five.
I like that.
Six.
So, and then put some real money behind this. National or regional marketing, you know, $250,000, $300,000 national campaign. You design it, so it's and then it's like people go to a big website and then, you know, learn more and residential, and then you can hit the different campuses. This, go to this one, and or online, and then you go to one. You know what I mean? So it's like a big campaign and a big draw, and admissions, and you use social media. That would be priority number two. And the third priority is to increase resources for investment. And that's going to be through philanthropy. That's going to be through operational efficiencies and maybe going to the Wesleyan Church and say, we need investment because we want to become something big. I'm making all that up, but that just succinct,
sounds pretty good, huh? Yeah.
Just succinct like that. And think of that for your own institution.
Okay, I apologize for not being in your earlier session.
That's all right. No. I wasn't trying to give you a hard time.
But a few follow-up questions. To what extent is the faculty involved in the strategic planning process, or should they even be involved in the strategic planning process? Secondly, who are the audiences and what are the purposes of that strategic plan? Is it just for fundraising purposes? Is it to show to strategic donors? Is it to give to our supporting churches to say, yes, we've got our act together,
yep,
so you can keep believing in us? Is it to give to our students, so they know that they've made a good choice to come to us. First of all, the role of the faculty.
Yep.
And who are the audience?
And we also didn't hit the trustees, which was the other. You asked me that earlier. So let me just say, the reason you do strategic planning is to inform decision-making of people in the institution about what they should be spending time on and what they should be investing the university's money in and what they have permission to move toward. So you're informing decision-making internally, but you're also using a strategic plan to build morale and make people excited about the place, which gets to the third one, which is to explain to external people why they should invest in you or come to your campus. So you have to speak to multiple constituents through the strategic plan, but it really has to guide decision-making and make people proud of a place and excited about its future. That's a quick summary of that. The faculty should absolutely be involved in the process. They can't not be involved, but they need to be involved in a controlled way. So same with trustees to a certain extent. So the faculty involvement should be a survey of all faculty during the assessment phase and the development of the ideas, and strategic planning should not take more than 4 months. That was another thing I covered in my other segment. Don't spend a year doing a strategic plan, especially if it's a three-year plan, which it should typically be. But there should be a survey, and they should be involved in town hall meetings where they can respond to things and give inputs. They have to be involved in shared governance. And students should be involved too. They should be surveyed as well as alumni. And the last thing is trustees should absolutely be engaged, but don't take it for granted, because I've seen some presidents just do their own plan and say, now approve it. So how should trustees be engaged? One is they should be requiring the strategy. So you should be clear that we need an explicit strategy for three years that includes financials and just key initiatives. Don't give us, 27 objectives and 72 initiatives. Give us the high level. So we need to have it produced. The second thing is you should be asked for your opinion. So whenever I do a strategy, I always survey the Board of Trustees as well and say, what do you think? All part of my SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. What do you think the strategy should be? What do you think the biggest strengths are that we can leverage? So they should be surveyed. Three is they should approve it. That's an obvious one, I guess. And four is they have to hold the cabinet accountable. So keep going back to it. Don't just do a strategic plan and next year you forget about it. Use it as a living document. Mm-hmm. So that was my whole session two in about 5 minutes.
So I didn't need to go.
You didn't need to go.
I was going to add a comment following up on the thing about projections, because I've been mulling over gearing up for our next round of meetings. The question they asked, how is this really different from any other? And one of the things that strikes me this year is both our investment policies and our spending policies will be impacted by the fact that for the first time in 5 or 6 years, we had probably a 20% decline in endowments as opposed to
from the market
20% increases.
Yeah.
This year's been terrible for the market.
For 5 years. And since most schools have spending rates that say we take the average of the last 5 years and a percentage of it, that's always fine when it's going up because your percentage is okay. But if you take that amount as a percentage of a depleted endowment, you have an interesting dilemma.
Yeah, and you should change those assumptions because next year might even be worse than this year.
Well, and so you have to think ahead to say, okay, when you give me your projections, are you projecting we're just going to take the endowment number as it would have been without adjustment, and are we having a spending rate that is some percentage of that? And so I think as trustees, those are kind of the things probably at our board level we'll be talking about to our finance and investment committee. We have our structure, but there's a separate investment committee for the endowment with its policies on spending, and New York is pretty regulatory.
I would expect to do some scenario analysis of that to say, what if the market went down 10%? Probably not too inconsistent with what we all do for our retirement planning. Yeah. Like we have Fidelity and my wife and I run through these. Although he always uses way below average returns. You ever do this where they can run your numbers? And my wife she's a partner at EY, so she always says that. And I said, what about just average returns over the next 20 years? And that makes us look a lot better, and that way we can have more dinners and stuff. And she goes, no, we have to go with the lowest average return. But no, the really good points. I did forget one thing. You mentioned it, philanthropy. A good strategic plan should be exciting for the campus, a vision to become something, and some new priorities of big change. And that should be tied to philanthropy. You should be able to go out and find people who are excited about the cause. Oh, you really want to grow the number of Wesleyan graduates? I'm behind that. Oh, you want to grow athletics? I'm making these up, but you know, probably you have some lower level priorities. You got some high level buckets, and then you have some more drill downs to appeal to people. We just did a huge campaign, and it all has to tie to strategy. Everybody, when they give money now, they want to know what you're going to use the money for and what the returns will be. So you have to be ready to tell that story.
This piggybacks on a conversation I had in an earlier session with someone about confidence in the leadership of the university. And this person made the comment, it's not just about the plan, but it's about having confidence in the leadership of the university to carry out that plan. Would you agree with that statement, that that's something the donors look for?
Absolutely. And it's competency of the leadership capability to manage it, but it's also charisma of the leader. So the let's face it, a big part of a president's roles is to connect with major donors. So they have to be able to tell the story, and they have to instill confidence. Yeah, if someone's not buying it, I don't think you're going to pull this off, they're not going to be inclined to invest. So it has to be that they have the ability to do it, and they also have the charisma to connect with donors.
Actually, the other side, I suppose, we have to think about when they come in with the budget and says, so next year we're forecasting a 5% rise in giving. It's like, is that realistic if most donors have lost 20% of their investment assets? Mm-hmm. If most people are used to giving at a certain percentage of their assets, how do we think about
that? That comment you made about the Fed rate, that was right on point. And as I said, I was on the finance investment, I think 7 years, it might have been eight. And at SWU, the spending and budgetary and the investment are both in the same committee. Just because we're so small, we don't have enough members to separate them. We probably should separate them. We run into this thing where the committees that award student scholarships at the university saying, we need more money, so we can pay more scholarships. So in good years, when the returns are looking good, it's like, you're getting all these returns. Why can't you pay us more money for scholarships? We've got all this more money for scholarships. But then when the market goes down and you have to pull back those scholarships, that creates all kinds of morale problems.
The pain is far worse than the gain you got earlier on. The pleasure people got in the good years gets dwarfed by the pain.
So you should be using a 12-quarter for your rolling average. So when it gets good, you don't award that much more.
Yeah.
You're using those lower years in there to smooth out the ups and downs of the market, because you don't want to be changing your endowment draw every time the market goes up and down.
Yeah.
That's not good. So that's what that philosophy is for. It's used,
expectations. When we have students leaving because we couldn't fund their scholarship this year, I mean, that really creates more problems.
You can't do that. You have to be able to draw.
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of communicating to the scholarship committee that, times are good, happy days are here again, but this is not going to last forever.
No, and that's when you smooth that out. You don't want to go up and down like that.
Yeah.
And typically, you want to start projecting 4 years forward, because you're probably going to give that scholarship 4 years.
Exactly.
And so it's not really just a one-time cost, because if in the second year you don't give them a scholarship, they sort of read it as you don't really want it.
Any other topics? I know you guys have had a full...
This is
I mean, it's back-to-back the whole time. I mean, 8 a.m. start with me.
It was a great start.
The good news is
I gave a lot of content.
It was good.
That's a lot for an early morning. And then you have more all day.
And at lunch.
Well... I had a pleasure working with all you all. My information is going to be on the slides. If anyone has any follow-up questions or wants any articles, or I hope to stay in touch with you. And I'm willing to have a motion to adjourn this meeting.
We have a motion that you keep track of, Matt.